Okay, thank you, Ferial. Always good to hear some good news stories and give us some food for thought for the future. Our next speaker is Fagmita Peterson-Cook. Fagmita is an actuary with 28 years of experience in investment and governance. Fagmita is a CDSA and holds a postgraduate diploma in global business from Oxford University, as well as a certificate in climate change and sustainability from the Institute of Actuaries. Fagmita is a seasoned investment professional with deep experience in asset management and insurance. She chairs the audit committees and investment committee of both corporates and institutional investors, including the APSA Pension Fund. A strong sense of the need for sustainability has been apparent in Fagmita's strategic thinking since the early 2000s. Fagmita currently holds a non-executive directorship of a number of listed and unlisted companies. She is the curator of 360 Life, a life insurance company ultimately owned by NUMSA Investment Trust, appointed by the Prudential Authority. Welcome, Fagmita.
Great, thanks for that introduction, Nicola. So, I think the mention of APSA Pension Fund is misleading there, but that's when you reuse a profile from another presentation, right? So I also chair the risk committee of Eskom Eskap, and Eskap is a subsidiary of Eskom. It's licensed to do insurance for parastatals and government entities. And it's really with knowledge that I've gained there that I'm speaking to you today. Obviously besides my ongoing passion in terms of work in the climate change space. I'd also just like to clarify that all views that I present today are my own. They're not the views of Eskom or Eskap. And really, everything that I'm going to cover today is actually in the public domain. So I really would encourage you to go and look at the model that the CSIR has prepared, because I think there's a lot of value in there. So, yeah, in terms of presentation, that's the agenda that I want to cover today. Talk to you about, just very briefly, the status of climate change in South Africa, and then really take you through the downscaling of the IPCC model for South Africa and what the learnings are from there, what the sort of more accurate forecasts are in terms of weather patterns for South Africa. And then I'm also going to talk just more generally about what you as short-term insurers should be doing. So climate change in South Africa was noted as one of the top risks in the South African Reserve Bank Financial Stability Review report for June 2024. And I'm going to read the extract from the report to you. Climate change, and this is under the heading Perpetual Risks That Pose Ongoing Threats to Financial Stability. Right, so climate risk. The increasing frequency and severity of extreme weather events driven by climate change pose physical risks to insurers and the broader financial system. Although all financial institutions are affected by climate change, in recent years, the insurance industry has been particularly hard hit. Climate change continues to contribute to a growing number of extreme weather events in South Africa, both in terms of frequency and severity. Adverse weather conditions have raised concerns over the climate insurance protection gap, which refers to the uninsured portion of economic losses arising from climate-related natural disasters. The transition to a greener economy also presents transition risks to business. So the Reserve Bank has identified a gap that exists in the insurance market. We all know it's there, and it's the part of the market that ends up having to rely on all of these non-governmental institutions that Ferial referred to earlier. So, for example, when we saw those horrific scenes of hurricanes and flooding in Durban in June, you know, there was no insurance that covers those informal settlements. It's the NGOs that had to step in and help government address the issues. So really, what is climate change? Firstly, let's make sure that we know what we're talking about. Climate change is the long-term change in temperature of the Earth's surface, including water temperature, as a result of the emission of carbons into the atmosphere. And those carbons are generated primarily from the burning of coal, oil, and gas. So where are we in terms of climate change in South Africa? So National Treasury, big rah-rah, released the green taxonomy about 4 years ago. We haven't really seen much come from that. And what they tried to do with it was create a common lexicon. I don't believe that the financial sector has embraced that as much as they should have. We've had climate change legislation promulgated on the 24th of April, 2024, just a few months ago. There's no effective date to this legislation. But what this legislation intends to do is allocate carbon budgets to particular sectors in South Africa. And if you're a company in that particular sector, you have to comply with your budget, or you will need to pay penalties. And there are three sectors that are identified at this point in time that will have budgets allocated to them. It's the energy sector, the transport and logistics sector, and the agricultural sector. And it's quite obvious that those are three big emitters. Eskom believes that it is ready to comply with the Climate Change Act requirements. And then the other, and I mean, there are lots of other pieces of legislation that impact, the carbon tax reporting that we now need to do in terms of scope 1 and scope 2 emissions. But the other thing that's really going to hit hit industry in South Africa very shortly is the European Border Equalization Tax. And that really says that if you're importing goods into the EU from a country where they don't have the same laws around carbon emissions, then a tax will be added to that good that gets imported in order to ensure parity of pricing of carbon emissions. And that's going to affect the competitiveness of South African exports. And so even if the imperative doesn't exist in terms of legislation in South Africa, we are going to see behaviors of South African companies change in order to accommodate for that. Okay. So that's just a brief review of where we are in terms of legislation, right? And I'll take you back to Mark Carney's seminal speech on climate change, right? So he presented this speech on my 40th birthday on the 29th of September 2015 at the House of at Lloyd's in London. And I didn't listen to it on my birthday, but I listened to it afterwards, and it's really been sort of motivating for me as an actuary, because we think in very long-term horizons, right? And his speech was entitled The Tragedy of the Horizons, obviously a play on the tragedy of the commons. And in his speech, you know, he commended actuaries for the way they are already starting to think about the impact of climate change. But he recognizes that climate change, well, at that time, was a very long-term problem, and the consequences were not immediately evident. I think with things like the cyclones that we've seen in South Africa, the flash floods and the storms that we've seen in South Africa and in Southern Africa, that horizon's getting shorter. But we're always faced with a trade-off of the urgent versus the important, right? And if you even look at where Eskom is right now, okay, we've had, the South African government has made a trade-off between, do we feed electricity from carbon sources into our economy at this point, or do we reduce our emissions immediately because we want to solve for this bigger long-term problem, right? And when the draft Integrated Resources Energy Plan came out last year in December, there was a very dramatic turnaround where the planned mothballing of a number of power stations up to 2030 was actually just put on hold, and Eskom was told, actually, we're not going to switch off these power stations. Get out there, get them back up to speed, maintain them, and burn them, because we need to supply the economy with energy so that the load shedding can end, so that people can be working full days and not be working short time. It was a difficult decision to make. Whether it's the right decision or not is really a matter of personal judgment, because people need to be working, companies need to be producing revenue, but there's this longer-term problem of climate change and carbon emission reductions that we need to make. We as a country have committed to something called the national contribution. So it's something that comes out of the Paris Agreement. And we're probably not going to meet our reduction commitments, but we are going to face the cliff in 2030 when we will have committed to have reduced our carbon emissions by a certain volume, which we will not have done. We're going to face an energy crisis at that point potentially, unless we make use of the time to add additional renewable resources and clean energy sources to the grid. But coming back to sort of why is climate change important to us now, we all want to leave a legacy. Our children are part of our legacy. And how old will your child be in 2050? And what planet will your child inherit? And that is why, you know, climate change is supposed to be an important subject for everybody, not just actuaries who need to think about it commercially. So just a very brief history of sort of how we ended up with the climate change debate that we have today. So in 1988, the United Nations established the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and really it was a grouping of scientists who needed to come up with a model for projecting the impact of climate change, so the impact of global warming on climate change, and they've developed these projections out to various dates, 2050, 2100, etc. And there's a lot of criticism around models, and we as actuaries will say, well, of course, no model is correct, and you're going to refine your model over time. We do that with our models all the time. There's no reason why the IPCC's model should be perfect, but it should give you enough to work with. It's an extrapolation of the future. It gives you scenarios to work with. It gives you possible futures to plan around, right? So there's lots of criticism out there, but that doesn't decry from the validity of the outcomes that you can conclude from the model. In any event, then we had the at COP in 2015, we had the Paris Agreement. So just by the way, South Africa hosted a COP in 2011. The GPF was part of the organizing committee, but it was a bit of a wet squib. It was held in Durban. I'm sure all the delegates who attended that conference back then will not recognize Durban now. We also hosted our COP. Then in 2017, we had the establishment of the TCFD. And in 2022, South Africa's own JSE issued the Sustainability and Climate Change Disclosure Standards. Those are voluntary standards. TCFD are also voluntary standards, but most insurance companies do actually do some reporting in terms of the TCFD. Okay, so coming to sort of the model of the moment, right? The CSIR is the Center for Scientific and Industrial Research in South Africa. Very strong research capability, modeling capability, etc. And what ESCOM did was, when ESCOM was presented with this potential change in the energy strategy, ESCOM wanted to understand the impact of the now increased climate emissions or carbon emissions on the South African climate. And ESCOM has sponsored the CSIR and developed a project together with the CSIR to take the global IPCC model of the impact of climate change and downscale it and make it applicable to South Africa. So the project's called the Regional Downscaling Experiment, which is an unfortunate choice of name. I don't believe it's experimental. There's strong evidence to support its accuracy. But basically what the CSIR has done has taken the six models which come together in the IPCC, and they have downscaled it and made it applicable to South Africa. And the result is a very high-resolution climate model, right, that presents simulations of the present-day climate, and it develops projections of what the future climate change will be in South Africa. And it creates scenarios for 2050 along the two sort of most popular IPCC scenarios. So just to take a step back again, you will surely have heard of the IPCC scenarios, four scenarios, and the most common scenario or the base case scenario is RCP 4.5. RCP stands for Representative Concentration Pathway. 4.5 does not refer to a degree. 4.5 is actually 4.5 watts per meter squared, and that's just a measure of the increase in the radiative flux on the planet. So in 2010, when they started with their modeling, the radiator flux, or the increase in the radiator flux on the planet from 1800 was 2.17. The model, or the base case scenario model, says, okay, if we want to limit the radiator flux increase to 4.5 by 2050, that's when we get our 2-degree average temperature increase scenario. And so the model looks at what the climate in South Africa is going to look like in 2050, assuming then we have the 4.5 watts per meter squared radiator flux, and therefore limit the average surface temperature increase to 2 degrees. There is also an 8.5 model, which is obviously, well, the worst case scenario in terms of the IPCC. And so the real output from this model is projections on what's going to happen to rainfall, wind, and temperature in South Africa in 2050. So I've covered quite a bit of what's on the slide already. But just fun fact for those of you who do run models, the model was run on the Maraca supercomputer at the CSIR's Maraca Institute. It apparently ran for 7 days. And quite importantly, this model has been downscaled for accuracy down to 8 kilometers resolution. So it can give you fairly accurate forecasts of where not to go and buy your holiday home or invest in property, which areas not to invest in property. Just to articulate the risks in terms of climate change, right? They should be obvious, but climate change for short-term insurance actuaries is going to result in extreme weather conditions that you need to model for and price for. And obviously there's a significant risk of climate action failure, which is kind of what we're seeing with a change in the Integrated Resources Energy Plan. It's man-made damage, and there's continuing man-made damage, and we need to have intervention around continuing man-made damage. There's also an implication for infectious diseases, and I'll explain that a bit when we talk about the temperature increase. And very importantly, there's a loss of biodiversity. And of course, loss of biodiversity leads to the increase in zoonotic diseases like we saw with COVID-19. Okay, CSIR model takeaways. Right, so I really would encourage you to go and look at the CSIR's website, look at the IPCC model. There's a lot of detail about how the model works, and I'm sure some of you who build models will be very interested to hear or to read about how they've done it. But quite importantly, a 2 degrees or 2.5 degrees average Earth surface temperature increase does not mean that the average temperature increase in South Africa is going to be a 2.5 degree temperature increase. Because of our geographical position, in South Africa, we're actually going to experience a 1.5 to 2 times increase in the global rate. So if the world leaders agree to negotiated contributions in reduction of global emissions to target a 2-degree increase, we in South Africa are actually going to experience around a 4-degree increase in temperature change. And the number, just one of the takeouts from the model, one of the facts to call out, is that the number of hot days that are experienced in the Northwest and Limpopo is going to increase by 50%. Now, if you've gone to Kruger in February, you know that you're facing temperatures of 45 degrees. That's what we mean by very hot days. Northwest and Limpopo have, on average, 50 to 70 very hot days. That number is going to increase to 100. That's almost a third of a year. And that is a significant increase in temperature. And you can obviously model the increases in demand. Eskom obviously looked at the increase in electricity demand for running air cons. But that's a very significant increase in temperature. And you need to understand, South Africa as a government needs to understand the implication for resource utilization as a result of that temperature increase. What does the model say about rainfall? It says that rainfall is generally going to decrease across South Africa, but it's going to increase over the central interior and east coast. And then specifically, the model looks at extreme weather events, right? And it says that extreme rainfall events are projected to increase in frequency and it's going to be accompanied by lightning, hail, damaging winds, and flash floods. And that really is where your property damage risk lies as short-term insurers. So in terms of specific warnings that the CSIR has called out, there's going to be an impact on agriculture and livestock. And if you think about this, with climates in areas changing, your vegetation is going to change, and what you can actually do from an agricultural activity perspective in certain areas are going to change. So what could have been cattle stock land before is probably going to become sheep stock land or sheep grazing, and what was sheep grazing will probably become arid and not suitable for agriculture at all. And there's significant food security implications that arise out of this for South Africa. And, you know, one of the things South Africa needs to think about strategically is forging relationships with other countries in Africa in terms of securing food supply. In terms of increased energy demand, I've already made the example around increased utilization of air conditioning. But as a result of that, government will also need to plan for a further increase in renewable energy. And then in terms of public health risks, right? So a lot of people in South Africa live in informal settlements. We know that. And they live in close proximity. And the increased health risks arising out of the temperature increases are particularly dire for poor and elderly people living in those circumstances, right, where they already have limited access to water and they have limited access to healthcare. So just living in close proximity means that diseases, which are going to be on the rise anyway, are going to spread more quickly. And from a government perspective, the South African government really needs to look at targeted public health interventions and improving the infrastructure for vulnerable communities. And we think here specifically about the vulnerable communities in areas like Limpopo and the Northwest. So in terms of reduced rainfall, we are going to end up with further water security risks. Ferial already spoke about water shedding, and that's perhaps due to incompetence and service delivery issues because the water is here. By 2050, we may well not have anywhere close to adequate water supply. And so government will again need to look at planning for building water capture systems in areas where we are expecting the rainfall to increase. And then we also share water sources with other countries. And again, we'll need to look at how we, as a country, advance our strategies for sharing water basins. In terms of the extreme rainfall events, which I've already alluded to earlier, right, it creates a risk of increased flooding and infrastructure damage, particularly in the central interior regions and also along the east coast. And again, we've seen the hurricanes and the tropical storms already. And government also needs to look at the infrastructure for water drainage. And again, infrastructure for water drainage in informal settlements. Because we all saw the pictures of the informal settlements in the KZN, you know, meter high in water. And government needs to develop infrastructure to deal with that and assist the vulnerable settlements who are at risk of these extreme events. So government needs to invest in resilient infrastructure to protect these vulnerable settlements from floods as well as the droughts. So we know that Paris tries to keep, the Paris Agreement agreed on reductions in carbon emissions to keep temperature increases to between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees. And, you know, we are very much at risk of not meeting those targets because countries are not meeting their commitments. In South Africa, we have this lexicon of a just energy transition because we need to have a just transition and an equitable shift to a low-carbon, resilient economy, ensuring that no one is left behind. South Africa is not doing very well against those measures at the moment because we're not retraining people to come out of, for example, the coal mining industry into other more sustainable jobs. We have greenhouse gas reduction targets, which we're not meeting at the moment, but we need to set clear plans as a country to meet those emission targets across key industries. And then I've spoken about the Climate Change Act, which will introduce penalties for non-compliance, but the Department of Forestry, Fishing and Environment still needs to develop the targets and then implement them, and then develop mechanisms for ensuring compliance against those targets. In South Africa, we really need to develop a plan for management of climate change and climate change action, which we don't really have at a national level. And then I've already spoken about balancing competing demands for energy, for the economy right now, and supporting jobs versus, you know, addressing the long-term risk of the impact of climate change. So those really, what I've just covered is really what comes out of the model. The IPCC model. And what I'm going to just talk about for the next few minutes is what you as actuaries need to be thinking of in your various roles. And I hope I'm speaking to a diverse set of actuaries now who, you know, are on the boards of insurance companies, who work in product development in short-term insurance companies, who work on the asset management side, in insurance companies, who work with investor relations for the Suntans of the world who are actually listed. And also tell you a bit about what other insurance companies are doing globally, and also what the regulatory trends are, right? So just in terms of focus areas for professionals, the companies that you're involved with need to have a strategy for climate change and sustainability. And I'm sure that if you do and speak to investor relations, there is something on paper, and you as actuaries need to think about how you give life to that strategy in the roles that you perform. Don't wait for it to be put into your KPIs before you actually start thinking about it, right? We all live on this planet. We're all in it together. We're all exposed to the efforts of the weakest link. And you need to think about how you make your company's climate change strategy your own and give it life in the roles that you do, that you fulfill. Think of what the opportunities are that you can look at for your company in the roles that you play. So if you're in product development, think about how you can give effect to township asset insurance, for example. You know, insuring shacks. And National Treasury are actually working on a project with the World Bank, looking at how they bring some sort of cat risk insurance to townships. And they want to implement that through municipalities to bring some protection to township dwellers. But think about how you can do this commercially, right? Digitization means that you can distribute for cheap. Social media means that you can get to anybody out there. Think about how you look at that in your product development. And it's not just limited to climate change, right? Because there is already a product out in the market that provides fire insurance and fire detection in the township market. Look at the framework that your company has for governance around climate change and see how you fit into that reporting chain, and make sure that your reporting does actually flow up that governance framework. Of course, we all think about the current costs of climate change impacts. We've seen it through increasing insurance premiums if we're actually on the consumer side of insurance. We've seen it in the increasing insurance premiums that we've needed to give through to our clients. On the reinsurance side, we've seen it through increasing cat cover premiums particularly. We've also seen it, though, in conditionalities that are being implemented in terms of reduction of availability and affordability of cover. And so we've had to get smarter around our own capital allocation challenges to make sure that we're using our capital efficiently. And Janine's actually going to talk later about how you use reinsurance, and I hope, Janine, you're going to touch on climate change in terms of cat risk as well. But we've also seen it in the companies that we invest in as insurance companies. So, I mean, obviously as insurance companies, we have diverse asset portfolios and we invest in equities, although very little. The last World Bank report said that short-term insurers in South Africa on average invest about 10% in equities. But we have seen it in depressed share prices in our investee companies. And we've also seen the implications for trade. So just dwelling for a moment on depressed share prices, I think as actuaries we also need to think about the risk of stranded assets for our investment portfolios. And I mean by stranded assets we mean the obvious things like Pegasa. Are you guys hearing a voice? No? Okay. You think of things like the data coal, but there are also other assets like real estate assets and asset-backed securities which face the risk of, you know, the underlying assets getting flooded or being struck by the risk of rising ocean levels, etc. Then in terms of risk management, you obviously are thinking about how you manage for climate change risk. You're incorporating it into your author. You're incorporating it into your risk appetite statement. The Prudential Authority made it the flavor of the year a little while back, and now there's guidance on how insurance company boards should be thinking about climate change risk, and hopefully that's also come down into sort of your products and your pricing. And, you know, it's not just about avoiding the risks, though. It's also about making sure that you build resilient portfolios and that you offer products which meet the needs which are going to come out of climate change risk. So think about the specific climate change risks that face your company. Obviously at ISCAP they're very evident. And those risks are obviously physical and transitional, but they are also liability risks that you need to think of. And then scenario analysis, that thing that we as actuaries love. I mean, don't you just love dealing with your authors? Scenario analysis, you know, you need to be thinking about your scenarios in the short term, in the medium term, and in the long term, and hopefully the CSIR model will help you enrich the detail in your model. I don't need to spell out to you what the various terms mean. So, we've spoken about the three categories of risk: physical, transitional and liability. And you need to think about your companies where you operate in your various roles and think about the time frame over which those risks manifest for you in the roles that you play, and understand the materiality of the different types of risks for your business. But you don't just think of climate change in the workplace. You think about climate change for you and your families and your children and your legacy. And there's also the risk of biodiversity loss. And there's a very interesting paper called the Descriptor Biodiversity Review, which I would encourage all of you to go and read. You can put it down as Professionalism CPD. We've spoken about stranded assets. But the other thing you need to think about is the risk of stakeholder rejection if you don't actually take action. So we've spoken about the obvious one in terms of depressed asset prices, where the stock market rejects your company because you're not behaving appropriately in terms of climate change. And it's obviously not just the equity stock market, it's the bond market as well. I'm sure lots of you hold Eskom bonds in your portfolio. Eskom are trying to make a difference here on the climate change agenda. But you also need to think about what your policyholders are going to think of you as a company in terms of the kind of risks that you insure. And of course, the view from your regulator as well, because your regulator needs to know that you're thinking about the risks that you are exposed to from a climate change perspective. I mean, then in terms of opportunities or actions, portfolio decarbonization is an obvious one, where you just disinvest from carbon exposure assets in your investment portfolios, and you retreat from insuring carbon assets, carbon related assets. You effectively avoid the emissions. But there's also an opportunity for climate solutions, right? Alternative risk transfer arrangements. And those are the things that the clever actuaries in this room need to be applying their minds to, because Eskom is still the biggest supplier of power in this country. And you know, investment opportunities for those of you who run investment portfolios, think of clean energy investment opportunities, think of carbon capture and destruction of high impact climate gases investment opportunities. So for those of you who work in the strategic area of a business, and again, whether it's on the short-term insurance side, whether it's on the investment side, or whether it's at a board level, it's important that you do a baseline assessment and understand where you are at now and what your business's exposure is to climate risk, what opportunities your business is already taking in terms of climate opportunities, and then thinking about what you can do in terms of climate change interventions. So set objectives. There's ongoing education required around climate change, right? So this should always be featuring on your CPD, because there's constant evolution of thought and knowledge on the area. We sit with the RCP IPCC models. The IPCC actually released new models in 2022, which is updated for new evidence which has come to light, because the original RCP models are just an extrapolation of the climate change trends that have been observed over the last century. So the new model tries to factor in more recent changes in climate change. So not just educating yourself, but making sure that the people that you are responsible for in the workplace also educate themselves, educate your boards as well. They rely on you for submission of material for them to apply their minds to. As an employer, you need to think about the health risks for your employees. If you're providing healthcare products on the short-term side, you need to be thinking of repricing your health risk products. And you obviously need to be thinking, particularly as reinsurers, you know, are you pricing your cat risk correctly? We've seen dramatic increases in the pricing of cat risk. Have we overshot? Are we approximately right now? How much more do we need to adjust the pricing? And obviously, cat risk is difficult to model, particularly where the risk itself is emerging and evolving, because then you know you need to think about how you model the emergence of that risk over time. For SA insurers in particular, there's a risk of a loss of global reinsurance capacity and the expansion of the utilization of reinsurers from non-equivalent jurisdictions, and you need to think about the implications of that for your reserving, whether you apply the standard models, whether you're going to go and develop your own economic model. You need to think about the allocation of resources as business, you know, in terms of how much resources do you allocate to applying their minds to the risk of climate change and to the product development, etc. I've already mentioned that, you know, put these items into your KPIs and the KPIs of the staff who report to you. If you're on the board, make sure it's in the KPIs of the CEO and the COO. Think about how you mobilize transitional finance, right? Whether it's in the OPEX area in terms of product development, whether it's in the CAPEX area in terms of alternative risk transfer arrangements. And then make sure that the management information exists so that you can monitor movement over time and so that you can report on it. There's a myriad of reporting that exists in terms of climate change. And again, I say here, what do investors consider? But you need to consider if you're managing the investments of the insurer, these are the aspects you need to consider. If you're a listed company, these are the aspects that your investors are going to consider as they consider investing in you. So what do investors need to consider? They need to consider disclosure that the company is making and the reliability of the numbers that are actually being disclosed. So what assurance is being provided over those numbers? And we know about the CDP disclosures, we know about the TCFD disclosures, as well as the JSE sustainability reporting. There are a myriad of global and South African rating agencies that also look at the data that gets produced. And you as an investor managing the assets portfolio of an insurer need to make sure that you're considering climate change and considering the ratings that come out of these rating agencies of your investee companies. And are you exercising your voting rights to influence the companies that you invest in terms of, you know, carbon emissions, carbon disclosure, carbon behavior changes? And then investors also consider whether KPIs around climate change are included in the short-term incentives and the long-term incentives of the executives. And of course, we know that the Prudential Authority also has guidance on remuneration of insurance company executives. So important for the PA as a stakeholder as well. So just looking at climate-specific reporting climate-specific reporting for insurance companies, you must all be familiar with the UNEP FIPSI, but that's the United Nations Environmental Programme, Financial Institutions, Principles for Sustainable Insurance. If you haven't read them, there's another thing for your CPD. And really what the UNEP FIPSI tries to do is give you guidelines about how to approach climate change as insurers, what to think about. It makes suggestions of actions that you can take, how you build resilient product portfolios, how you think about your investments. I've mentioned the JSE sustainability standards already, and then of course listed companies and South African businesses need to report on scope emissions to SARS. I'm heading towards close now, but you know, we all know that climate change is going to need a system change, right? And a system change really means that we all need to do things very differently. It's not about tweaking on the margin. And I mentioned earlier that climate change is not just something you need to think about in the workplace. You need to think about how it affects you and your personal life. You think about how it's going to impact your children and your great-grandchildren. But you also need to think about how you need to adapt to climate change, but what you can do to limit climate change as well. And obviously the biggest emitters are energy, but agricultural stock, bovine agricultural stock in particular, is also a big emitter, and that's why we try to be plant conscious in terms of our diet. We try to use renewable energy. Those of us who can afford it probably implemented solar panels. Furiel asked the question earlier. Probably implemented solar panels at home, you know, because we were frustrated with load shedding, but it does mean that we're making a contribution to a reduction in carbon emissions. It's going to help us deal with future electricity price increases as well. But you know, think further about what else you can do to help support the reduction of carbon emissions, and yeah, how you adapt your life to reduce them. So Nicola, I'll stop there. That's the website for the CSIR SA climate change scenarios. There is some detail about the model there as well. And happy to take questions. Thanks.
Do we have any questions in the room?
I agree with you about starting to think about how we can integrate climate-related risks into our work. But what do you think are some of the gaps in our current skills and knowledge as actuaries that we need to close in order to operate in this space effectively?
Yeah, thanks. Some of the gaps are really what I've tried to address in the presentation, right? So really understanding what climate change means for South Africa. Because, I mean, a lot of people just thought, oh, well, 2-degree temperature increase globally means we're going to have a 2-degree temperature increase. And I think it's when you start seeing the consequences of climate change that you start to understand how severe the implications are. And so for me, really, I think the first thing is to understand the output from the model in terms of what is climate change going to look like for South Africa. So getting to understand that we're going to go from sort of 70 very hot days to 100 very hot days. And remember, that's just in terms of the RCP 4.5, right? If you look at RCP 8.5, the forecasts are far more dire. But I think understanding what climate change means and, you know, how it's going to impact over various time horizons is the first key to creating an interest in the subject. And you can then, you know, get people to move to action. I think for us as short-term insurers, we've seen it already in our claims experience, in our property damage, right? But we're seeing it in agricultural insurance as well. And, yeah, it's going to start coming through in healthcare costs as well. Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks, Fakmira, for that presentation. Passion for this clearly comes through. So I really liked the slide. So, my question to you is just asking, what are your thoughts in terms of the uninsurability risk, especially coming from climate change?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it's very real, and we're starting to see it come through already in certain companies that I'm involved in. And that's why the alternative risk transfer mechanisms are very important. So, for example, one of the global reinsurance brokers has established a coal pool, right? And it tries to operate on much the same way that the global nuclear pool works, you know, which Eskom obviously also participates in because of our two nuclear installations. But uninsurability means that you're going to see an increase in the utilization of cell captives. You're going to end up with a lot of capital being utilized by the parties at risk in first party cell arrangements. And I think we need to, as an industry and as a profession, think of how we assist in that area to make those risks insurable through alternative risk transfer mechanisms. But I'm really looking forward to your presentation on that later. Yeah.
Hi. Kind of two questions. One very quick question. You mentioned the CSIR model. I'm assuming that's mainly for physical risk. But you mentioned the resolution was 8 kilometers. I know certain corporate companies overseas, they have resolutions where it's closer to 1 kilometer. Obviously, depending on the data available, it will be reduced. So in the UK, obviously, it's a lot higher granularity. Do we have plans then for the CSIR to kind of implement more accurate and a smaller grid here in the future? Because 8 kilometers, again, it's quite large. There'll be quite a lot of different assets in that phase.
Yeah. So the model was originally 50. The downscaling was for 50 kilometers, right? So the 8 kilometers is already sort of further downscaling of the model. And I think just with the input factors that we have, you're going to run the risk of spurious accuracy. So I don't know of any plans to move to further downscaling. I'm already a bit skeptical about, as I say, the 8 kilometer outlooks. Yeah.
And then, so in relation to the uninsurable risk aspect, I know in America and they're starting to use government subsidies for insurance risks in the Florida region where they have high rates of hurricanes and that. Is coming from ESCAP and obviously more of a government and SOE entity, is that something that we can expect or that we would that we could hope for government to step in? I know obviously they have other priorities, but specifically also with the local municipalities, and someone mentioned it earlier about the focus on local municipalities to correct infrastructure. Is it something that you would see or that you would hope to see in the future?
Yeah, so at ESCOM, or at ESCAP, we operate completely independently from government, right? But what I have mentioned is what National Treasury are looking at to distribute through the local municipalities in terms of managing the cat risk, in terms of storms for informal settlements. They're working with the World Bank on that initiative. And the World Bank has a product that it wants to incorporate into that solution. I know that there are also potential cat bond solutions to the risk. Philip Peterson, who I used to work with on the Board of Africa Re, actually is quite involved in that cat bond program. I'm optimistic that something will come to fruition, but I'm not sure of where they are in the development of the solution. But it is on NT's agenda. Yeah.
Thanks for coming. Putting your investment hat on, are there opportunities that you see as a result of renewable energy rollout, for example? I've heard for a while now people talking up the need for much more copper, huge amounts of copper go into wind turbines and so on. Are there sort of niche investment opportunities to take advantage of it, given all the bad news and all the costs? Where can we hope to get something positive out of this?
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of investment opportunities. So, you know, according to the agenda, I'm from the APSA Pension Fund, so I actually chair the investment committee of the APSA Pension Fund. And previously, I was the chief investment officer of the Eskom Pension Fund. And we had there at EPPF and now at APSA Pension Fund, we have a significant drive towards investment in carbon emission reduction. And there are a number of themes that you can think about around carbon emission reduction and also supporting renewable energy. So in South Africa, the renewable energy investment space is fairly well developed because of the government guarantee that came through on the earlier rounds of the renewable energy IPP program. So you do have pension funds that have invested in that space. GPF is a big investor. You know, a couple of the bigger DB funds have invested because it's long term and it's fixed private equity type of investment. There are also a few listed companies that give you investment opportunity there. So AREP, which is part of the ARC portfolio, is a listed company that gives you investment opportunity there. But generally, copper, there's a big need for that. In terms of other assets that you can invest in for decarbonization, there's lots of innovative tech investment that's available, perhaps not locally, but internationally, and also through listed private equity, which sounds like a contradiction in terms, but it is available in Europe. There's investment opportunity in clean tech, in biofuels, and yeah, I think it's about understanding the companies that are available on the stock market that do invest or do research in those areas and offer products.
Agmina, thanks for the presentation. Very upsetting to hear these things. It's the world we live in, right? I'm just curious. You mentioned a few times that we're at risk. South Africa is at risk of not making our targets by 2030. Is that actually accounting for the spike in the renewable energy product actually rolled out in years? Heard a stat that last year, for example, or this year, that the number of renewable projects or solar panels has doubled, or more than doubled, than what it was last year. So just curious to see how we're still not meeting our targets, even if we see these big spikes in the renewable energies.
Yeah, so it is factoring in all the renewable energy investment that we have made. So Eskom hasn't released the 2024 results yet, right? But based on the 2023 results, 92% of the energy in South Africa still came from carbon-fired emissions, right? So either coal or oil or gas. And I think the important thing you need to bear in mind is that a lot of renewable energy solutions are not base load, right? They're intermittent because it's dependent on the sun or it's dependent on wind actually existing. And so if you have a solar system at home, right, you know you might be rated for 7 kilowatts, but at any point in time your system's perhaps producing 6 kilowatts, and in the morning until 11 it's producing 3 or 4, and in the afternoon after 3 o'clock it again drops off. So what it says on the nameplate in terms of the capacity of a solar installation is not what it delivers even during all the sunshine hours, right? It typically delivers a third of that rating during the sunshine hours. And look, we've now made the country in terms of the Integrated Resources Energy Plan has made the decision to go back to sort of getting all the coal going so that, you know, we can power the economy. And we need to make use of that time that we're buying ourselves, although not really, because now we're producing all these carbon emissions. We need to make use of that time to develop the renewable energy solutions. And the Integrated Resources Energy Plan at the moment, I mean, the budget for solar is so small, the budget for wind is so small in terms of what's provided for in the Integrated Resources Energy Plan. Historically, the private sector would have been limited to what they could actually apply for licensing for by what was in the IREP. Of course, they're no longer limited with that licensing requirement, and so they're not constrained by what's provided for in the IREP, but ESCOM is still constrained by what's provided for in the IREP. And I mean, one of the big tragedies, I think, about the renewable energy space in South Africa is that we don't make use of CSP sufficiently, so that's concentrating solar power. So that's where you use radiation from the sun to melt salt or heat oil, which then, you know, heats up to a temperature of about 700 degrees and produces and can actually produce baseload energy. So those systems use their own energy during the night to keep the medium at the required 700 degrees temperature so that it can continue producing energy. So ESCOM actually have a pilot. It's called Kiwana. It's in the somewhere in the north of the country. And a couple of the mining companies have small CSP installations. But, you know, that's potentially one of the solutions we have. From a geographical position, we have one of the best positions for radiation for CSP, only beaten by Chile globally. But, yeah, we don't really make use of CSP, and it's not provided for in the IREP.
Okay, thank you, Fakmida. I think we are out of time. The number of questions, I think, just shows how topical everything is.